Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest great adventure from Life on Planet Porky, and that's with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, I have to say that only a few hours ago, as we're sitting here now and recording this, I was absolutely shocked and hurt, really, and damaged by hearing of the death of Dennis Waterman. And for those who are a lot younger than me, Dennis Waterman was that's the Sweeney, and then he was also Minder. And the guy,
and how did it go? How did the theme tune go?
I could be so good to you, you could be so good to me, da da da. It was something like that, wasn't it?
I'm enjoying the variation on the lyrics.
Okay, fine. But what I'm saying is Dennis Waterman, terrific character actor. And I tell you how good he was, right? So he was George Carter, Detective Sergeant George Carter in the Sweeney, to John Thor's inspector. And John Thor was Jack Regan, okay? And the only night of the week I never went out before 9 o'clock was on Thursday night, because I used to be a regular at the King's Disco in Chester, okay?
Oh, I bet you did,
Oh, yeah, I was. And I would get out with my mates by at least 7.30, get a few pints down us, and then get into the disco by at least 10 o'clock. But no, Thursday night was the Sweeney, and, you know, my mates couldn't believe, what do you mean you can't come out until after nine? I said, well, the Sweeney's on. I watch the Sweeney. And it was brilliant. But anyway, look, to get down to
it. And, of course, in those days, we couldn't pre-record anything. We couldn't watch anything on catch-up or iPlayer. There were none of those facilities back then.
Leslie,
so if you wanted to watch something, you had to stay in.
You are so right, honestly. We didn't even have a video recorder in those days. You're so right, honestly, you know. A few years later, a few decades later, actually, you could record the programme and then watch it tomorrow morning. But no, if you didn't watch it,
that's if you could work out how to use the video recorder, which I never could.
That's right. And you know what? The great irony of all this is that these days I can watch the Sweeney every day of the week on a channel called Dave. Okay,
and I bet you never do watch it.
and honestly, I sometimes do, and it's not just the fact that it was a great program, but it's the fact that everybody's driving around in Ford Capris. You know what I mean? And everybody's walking around in flared trousers, and everybody's using the language of those days. Come on, son, we're the Sweeney. We have not our tea, you're nicked, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it was just brilliant stuff. But
I was talking to my kids about it, and they didn't even know what the Sweeney meant.
Yeah,
so I said, come on, we've been talking rhyming slang in the house for years.
Yeah.
But of course, that we would never have had an occasion to use the term Sweeney Todd, as in Cockney rhyming slang, for the Flying Squad.
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed for putting that on the line to our millions of listeners, Miss Jones, as always, because you are the wordsmithness of huge ability.
But you're the wordsmithness. I like that. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. But listen, what is more interesting to our millions of listeners is, I spoke to you this before we got on to recording, you told me your dad played football with Dennis Waterman.
He did. Yes, there was, you may not remember this, it's quite a long time ago, but there was, and it was founded in 1957, I discovered, a football team that raised money for charities and hospices and special schools and things like that called the Showbiz 11. And on that side, you had artists like Ray and Dave Davies from The King. You had
Brilliant.
Sean Connery, Tommy Steele, Jimmy Tarbuck, Anthony Newley, who was married to Joan Collins at the time, Lonnie Donegan, Des O'Connor, Patrick McGowan, people like this. You also had a smattering of former pros. They wouldn't allow current pros to play in the side because it was an amateur's side, obviously, and it used to play other charity football teams. But my dad's great friend George Easton was in that side.
George Easton was a footballer who played for Stoke City. I remember very well. Am I right?
You're probably remembering it better than I could, but also I know Billy Wright played for the team because Billy Wright used to come to our house quite a lot.
Billy Wright was captain of England and captain of Arsenal. My God, wow.
And Wally Barnes. Wally Barnes was a wing half, I think.
Wally Barnes, I think, was a goalkeeper, wasn't he?
I thought he was a wing.
Well,
anyway.
You may be right. Yeah, go on.
He was a commentator and he joined the team. Mike and Bernie Winters.
Mike and Bernie Winters.
I mean, you never hear those names now, do you?
I love it. I love it.
But do you remember the Aberfan disaster in South Wales? They raised money for that.
Yeah.
The Bradford fire.
Yeah.
All kinds of charitable things. So my dad used to bring all these people home. We had Sean Connery at the dinner table was Sean Connery.
Was he James Bond at the time?
No, he wasn't. Pre-James Bond and very fit and handsome.
Sorry, pre-James Bond or after James Bond?
Pre-James Bond. Well, this is going back a long, long time. My dad was just a young football writer then.
Yeah.
And we had, who else did we have? Jimmy Tarbuck came around a few times. Tommy Steele, who my mum absolutely loved. But in later years, they had in the lineup people like Rod Stewart, Freddie Starr, and Dennis Waterman crept in, you see.
Right.
And also Paul Gascoigne played for the team.
Oh, fantastic.
And Vinnie Jones. And when my mum used to fall out with my dad quite regularly because he was never at home very much. And on Sundays, they always played these Showbiz 11 matches.
Right.
We were just tiny kids. And my mum would do this terrible thing. If dad was going off to play in one of these football matches, she would make him take us with him and to give her a break. So my brother and I.
Give him a problem, obviously.
Yeah, just little kids. And this one particular match, which sticks in my memory, my dad got felled on the pitch and he broke his leg.
No.
And he ended up being carted off to hospital with two little children in the back of the ambulance, which was us.
What, you remember going to hospital with your dad in the ambulance and he had a broken leg?
And he broke his leg. Of course, then he couldn't drive back. My mother couldn't drive at the time. So all hell broke loose. So my father never forgave her for this chaos because she'd made him take the kids to the football match.
Golly, that's absolutely amazing. I want to tell a story about Dennis Waterman to you, Miss Jones, because you are rightly given the title by myself of a rock chick writer extraordinaire. So, let me put a few names together. Your family also know Terry Venables very well, the former manager. Very well indeed.
Yes.
And he used to come, didn't he, to your lunches and all that kind of stuff?
He's my sister's godfather.
Sister's godfather, right.
When Terry first came to London, well, he was from London, obviously, but when he first left home and he was a professional footballer, he lodged with my mum and dad, and he was 17 years old.
Incredible. So anyway, I, in what we call in our profession a resting year, i.e. between getting sacked and getting a job again, I went to work for the Football Association for a year. Just 1 year.
I remember you doing that.
It was a fantastic year. And the manager of the England team was Terry Venables. And Terry and I got on very, very well for a number of reasons. Firstly, you know the guy who got done for the Diana documentary? What's his name again?
Bryce. Was it Bryce?
No. I mean, the guy who really got done by Diana's brother for stitching him up and all that kind of stuff. You know, can't remember his name now.
I can't. Either.
Bashir, was it Bashir?
Oh, Martin Bashir.
That's right. Yeah, prior to the Diana thing, he did a piece on Terry Venables when I was working at the FA, and I managed to absolutely lacerate all of Bashir's accusations against Terry. And Terry respected me enormously for being such a good journalist that I managed to fillet everything that Bashir accused Terry Venables of. Now, I have to say that Terry was did sail a bit close to the wind sometimes, but he was a great guy, as you know, because you're funny known.
He was creative with his law bending,
He was creative. But Terry said to me once, he said, Mike, said, what do these guys expect me to do? Do they expect me to be a normal footballer and go out on the piss every afternoon after training? Or do they admire me for doing something else and trying to invest in business and trying to create things and write? He wrote the Hazel series, didn't he, for TV and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Yeah. That was Nicholas Ball. And everybody said at the time that, oh, because it went under a pseudonym, P.B. Ewell, I think.
Right.
I've got some copies of those books kicking around somewhere.
Okay.
And people said, oh, he doesn't write this stuff. He just gets a writer to kind of, you know, he'll sit there and talk to him and the writer will take it all down and turn it into stories. That wasn't true.
No.
Terry was writing the story.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Anyway, the point of this very long, drawn-out story, Miss Jones, is that I went to see Terry and had lunch with him in a hotel, which is at the end of Sloane Street, right? So you know where Sloane Square is, you know where Sloane Street is. There's a five-star hotel at the other end where Terry, in the days after I'd stopped working for the Football Association and I'd got into radio and all that, Terry and I kept in touch. And I can't remember that. It's a five-star hotel and I can't remember its name.
So whereabouts, not just off Sloane Square, you mean?
If you walk down Sloane Street, past Sloane Square, it's at the other end and it's a five-star hotel, but it's got an internationally famous rib room. Okay, that's all I can tell you. Rib thing.
That sounds like some sort of correction facility.
No. I mean the beef and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but it sounds rude.
Yeah, well, it does, but it's about the beef. So,
it's all about the beef, but the beef will trouble.
Yeah. Hey, where's the beef? That was a famous expression, by the way, that American presidents used to use against their opponents. You know, okay, this guy thinks he's got it, but I want to know, man, where's the beef? Because, of course, America is built on beef burgers, you know, and that kind of stuff. Anyway, getting...
So Keith Richards also uses that expression.
Really?
Because when they were talking about banning honky-tonk women for being racist and sexist and all the rest of it,
down in New Orleans. Yeah?
Yeah, that. And he said, I can't quite figure out what the beef with the sisters is, meaning what is their problem?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So it's got that meaning as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, you obviously got it. Right, now we're at least four directions away from our original story here, Miss Jones, but that's what the...
the usual.
Yeah, that's what the Planet Porky podcast is all about. So I'm getting now to... So I saw Terry in the rib room, okay, and we had a lunch and... He was thinking about writing another book. I think actually Terry Venables must have the record of writing literally seven autobiographies. I'm not joking, you know.
Do you know when he got the job managing Barcelona?
Yes.
Yes. I remember the dinner round at my parents' house and my father said to him, because he was having Spanish lessons already and he mastered the language pretty well.
He did.
And I remember clearly my father saying to him, Terry, the minute you hit the runway, Barcelona, start your diary and keep a diary and write notes in it every day. You don't have to write a lot, but write down every day what you did, what you thought about it, and what your sort of takeaway thoughts of those moments. And he said, do that assiduously every day for the entire time you're there, and then you will have Terry Venables' diary of his years at Barcelona.
Yes. Fantastic.
So the best advice in the world, isn't it?
And did your dad then write his books for him?
No, Terry wrote his own.
Yeah, well, he did. Well, I wrote two of them for him. I mean, I didn't write, but I...
Oh, did you?
No, I directed him and I said, that'll make that work. That's why we're having this lunch. And you're absolutely right here, Miss Jones. You're ahead of the game again. And he'd show me notes from this. And I said, no, that won't make Terry. No, nobody... That'll make... Oh, build on that one, all that kind of stuff. You see what I mean? So that's what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, point of my story is, this hotel, yes, I know, this is a long... was it in the Sloane Street? Anyway, I come out and I was at the time, you know, I was going back, I think I worked for the Press Association at the time. I was running the Press Association. I turned the Press Association from being a small national news agency into one of the biggest in the world. You know what I mean? Influential and told everybody what was going on. So as I'm walking back, I go, there's a square in the middle of Sloane Square. Obviously, that's why it's called Sloane Square. But I didn't know there is an underground car park there, okay?
I didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that either. As I'm walking past, the stairs from the underground car park, there's two people coming up and they're making an awful lot of noise. I'm not joking. It was, you know, what do you know about it? Don't speak to me like that. How dare you? Fuck you. All this kind of stuff. You know, honestly, these two people coming up from these stairs into Sloane Square.
Lingo, Mr. Parry.
Sorry?
Lingo. It's a family show.
Well, I know it is, but I excuse myself by saying that is direct quotation of what I heard, okay?
Verbatim.
Verbatim. Thank you. Yeah, that's a great journalistic expression. Verbatim. It means, yes, I heard and I wrote it down in shorthand, word for word. Anyway, let's go on. So I walked past a bit, thinking that's a bit unusual. And guess what? The two people who emerge from these stairs are Dennis Waterman and Rula Lenska, right? Who was his third wife. It is Rula Lenska.
The flame-haired beauty who used to star in Rock Follies on television.
Right. I mean, you couldn't miss this woman, I'm not joking. She had, I'm not joking, like a hedge over her head, and it was auburn and ginger. And I'm not saying that, by the way, in any detriment. She looked fantastic, you know, beautiful.
Do you know what I always wondered? Did the collar match the cuffs?
Sorry, Miss Jones, is that some sort of secret message about the way women dress or something? Yeah.
No, you know what that means. No? If somebody's got hair, a very striking hair colour, yeah. Does the collar match the cuffs?
Well, that one's lost me. But I'm sure our millions of listeners will pick up on that. Anyway, so no joking, I kind of stood there and, you know, I realised, crikey, that's Dennis Waterman. And, you know, as I've already said in this podcast, I, you know, watched him, admired him for years in The Sweeney and then Mindra, all that kind of stuff, and Rula Lenska. So, of course, I thought, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And I said, oh, hi, you know, yeah. I said, hello, Dennis, is it? He said, what's it got to do with you? Because they were having a terrible row. I'm not joking.
Somebody caught a right ding-dong. Was that what was going on?
Yeah. And I said, look, I thought, you know how it is, Leslie, I'm better than me. Do you reveal yourself as a journalist at that stage and be honest and open, or do you try and be a rat and just say, are you all right, mate? Is everything okay? Is your wife giving you a problem? Or you could say to Rulenska, is this man bothering you? You know what I mean?
Whichever way you go with that one, you're going to end up flat on your back, aren't you, really?
Anyway, he literally told me to F off, right?
I bet he did, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I can't be, you know, really duplicitous, but I need this story. So,
So you then said, actually, Mike Parry, Daily Express.
No, I didn't, honestly, because I was working for the Press Association at the time.
Oh, well, okay.
But, right. But anyway, listen, hear this out. So I said, oh, okay, no problem at all. Thank you very much indeed, you know, and no. Anyway, I then tipped off, funny you should say that, a great friend of ours on the Daily Express called Garth Pearce.
Lovely Garth. Don't we adore
right?
Garth?
Okay.
Garth, if you're listening, we miss you.
Now, of course, I had obligations to the Press Association, but we didn't really have a showbiz team. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I thought, I know somebody could do this, you know. So, I don't know. And I said, no. I said, I saw Dennis Wharton, Rulenska, absolutely having a time. Anyway, Garth, being as clever as he is, didn't go round and see Rula Lenska himself. He had a colleague who was a female showbiz writer, and he sent her round, and she literally opened the floodgates of the difficult relationship that she was having with Dennis Waterman. And it made, you know, front page story and a spread and all that kind of stuff. But Garth, being a very honest man, said, Mike, we've got it, and it's going to be home tomorrow. And we were able, on the Press Association, to put it out at 4 a.m. in the morning in the days when there's no social media. Do you see what I mean?
It's 4 a.m. in the morning.
No, what I'm saying is... No, Miss Jones, you know, could you be a bit more professional about this, please?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
What I'm saying is there was no social media in those days. The only news network going out 24 hours a day was the Press Association. So although it's going to be in the Daily Express and most people get their newspapers on the doormat at like 7 a.m. in the morning, okay, Garth tipped me off and I put it out on the Press Association at 4, which was too late for any other national newspaper to pick it up. So that was quite a good arrangement, wasn't it?
Very good coup, yes. Yeah. What one, you know, reading all the stuff, the obituaries and all the bits and pieces since he died, I really actually lost respect for him when I read this quote they were talking about, because
he hit Rula Lenska, he did,
and it was well known, you know, she wrote pieces about it, she was interviewed, it was all over the place that she was a beaten wife. So, and I was thinking, comparing this to the Amber Heard Johnny Depp thing, because it was because Amber Heard wrote about herself having been a beaten wife that this all started in the first place with those two.
Yeah.
But so Dennis Waterman turned around and said, when challenged about this, he said, she wasn't a beaten wife, she was hit. There is a difference.
Yeah.
And I thought, how low do you go?
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's nothing to be proud of. In fact, these days it's classed as assault and it's a criminal offence.
I saw that and, you know, then I had to rethink about my admiration for Dennis Waterman. But then I looked at it and do you know where he said that? He said that on an interview with Piers Morgan. It was a Piers Morgan life story.
Oh, one of those specials life stories, yeah.
Piers Morgan life story. Yeah.
Well, he never took it back.
No, he never took it back. What he said was this, and I am in no way excusing a man ever hitting a woman. I've never hit a woman, and I never would, and I think it's disgusting, and I'd have a go at any bloke who hit a woman. But he said one thing which kind of resonated with me. He said, sometimes when you've got a woman who is brighter than you, more intelligent than you, and she's talking it sensibly and you can't respond, the only thing you do is lash out. And, you know, I swear to you, Leslie Ann, it's never happened to me. I've never done it, but I know exactly what he's talking about. Men's egos sometimes can't handle the fact that the woman they're in company with are brighter than them. What's the answer? How do they react? Bang, lash out. I know it's shocking and I would never defend it, but I understand, you know, I understand what, you know, motivated him to do it, for want of a better word, you know.
I do get what you're saying. It sounds as though they had tempestuous arguments pretty much all the time.
Yeah.
And that she perhaps taunted him and belittled him, maybe. We're just guessing in those arguments. And she, because she was, she's a countess, I think.
Yes.
By birth.
She is, yeah.
And she's very sort of aristocratic, elevated, well-educated.
Yeah.
And she may have lashed at him with her very clever tongue, and he probably had a very short fuse and reacted in the only way his psyche knew how.
Yeah.
What he should have done was control himself.
Yeah, of course.
Walk away, leave the house,
go down
the road, come back the next morning, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it took to control himself.
Yeah.
And this is the lesson that men who are inclined to boil over at the slightest provocation, this is the lesson that they need to learn.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Just to back up Dennis Waterman, he did say in the same Piers interview, I am very, very ashamed. And at least he's not trying to, you know, get out of it by saying I had mental issues or anything like that, you know. And I don't know, from a man's point of view, it's impossible to understand how you could strike a woman. But, you know, I don't know. That guy did so many things right in life, if you see what I mean. Gave so many people, millions of them, so much pleasure and joy. I wouldn't like him to remembered for that. What must have been, I don't know, a fraction of a second, you know, aberration. But
I know what you're saying.
But I understand exactly with you. It's unforgivable. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with, I always introduce myself first, which is a bit unfair because the star of this podcast is the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, listen, I think I've got to explain to our millions of listeners, half the podcast's over already. We've only had one story. We've only talked about Dennis Waterman. Just before we get off Dennis Waterman, did you know that a couple of politicians, I don't know why I'm laughing, but I'm sure Dennis would, after he died, came up to her and said, "I'm so sorry to hear of the death of Pete Waterman."
I know, I saw it. I think Kay Burley on Sky News was one of them, wasn't she? Yes. And she tweeted it. She did have the good grace to withdraw the tweet and then to say, "I made a mistake and now I've deleted it."
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose it's an easy mistake to make if you're not really aware of who those people are.
Well, it reminds me of a situation with my great friend, Mr. Alan Brazil. We come into work one morning and we're on radio and the great American comic actor has died who's got the same name as the singer from Take That. Now, who am I talking about here? Remind me.
Gary Barlow, Robbie Williams.
Robbie Williams and Robin Williams, right?
Oh, yes. Right, there you go.
So Al comes in and Robin Williams has died, okay? You know, it's only happened a few minutes before, you know. And, well, it happened about half an hour before and Al was in his car coming in. He heard it on the radio and he rang his wife, Jill. And he said, "Oh, I can't believe it. Jill, I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe it. Robbie Williams has died." And she said, no, Al, it's not Robbie Williams. It's Robin Williams. Oh, the American actor. Oh, right. So Al gets on to air and tells his story. He says, "Oh,
I didn't know he was Pakistani."
Yes, well, thank you very much, Miss Jones. You know, so Al comes in and tells his story. He says, "Oh, Porky," he says, "you won't believe it." He says, "I thought this morning I'd been told that Robbie Williams has died. So I ring my wife, Jill, and I says, 'I can't believe Robbie Williams has died.' And she said, 'No, it's right, Al. It's Robin Williams.' And I said, 'Oh, I'm so relieved.'"
Oh, no. Oh, dear. Oh, that's shocking. So,
yeah, but Al didn't mean it like that. You know what I mean? He wasn't.
No, but it's the way it came
out. Exactly.
But
he wasn't happy.
You are going to have to be a little careful, I think, here, because you can be accused of cultural appropriation by mispronouncing Alan Brazil's accent.
No, I don't think I can. Alan and I are very good friends. We work together a lot. And Al actually has praised me many times for my interpretation of his accent. Miss Jones, you've written a book about the Stones. I think it's called The Stone Age. I think it's about 60 years of the Rolling Stones. I've said to you over the last couple of years that we've been working together, how long can the Stones go on? This can't go on forever. Men of 80 years of age, on stage, still trying to play and pretender in the 20s. What do I read today, Miss Jones? They can't sell tickets for their concerts.
Well, the reason they can't sell tickets for especially the Hyde Park concerts this summer is because they are ridiculously overpriced. I know somebody I was talking to a couple of days ago. She paid £650 for a standing room only ticket to the Hyde Park gig. Yeah. And she has to stand up all day in the blazing sunshine, presumably, unless it pisses down. And she has paid £650 for that.
Right.
They are ridiculously overpriced.
Why are they charging that then? Who charges these prices?
Well, they've always charged inflated prices. Yeah. The most I've ever paid for a ticket to a Stones gig was about £400.
Right.
And that was to Twickenham in 2018.
Miss Jones, you don't pay to go to gigs. You get invited backstage. What are you telling me?
When I was a journalist on national newspapers, I was invited and I always had backstage passes and all the rest of it. But I haven't been a full-time staff journalist since 1997.
But you're still in the mix. You're still in the good people, you know?
Yes, but those days have gone in terms of guest lists, free tickets, all of that kind of thing. It's a very rare occasion when anybody invites me.
Okay.
So I buy my own tickets along with the rest of the guys.
Okay, right, okay. So tell me, they're overpriced. So what happens?
So either they bring the prices down, in which case all the people that have paid for, you know, full price tickets already will kick up a stink, quite rightly.
Yeah.
Or they might consolidate the two concerts that they have scheduled for Hyde Park into one.
Yeah.
Or they may cancel part of the tour.
Tell me about this Hyde Park thing, Miss Jones, because Hyde Park's a big place, okay? So they have a concert in Hyde Park, but It's so big. Why would you buy a ticket? If you just went on the edge of where it was, you'd hear everything anyway, wouldn't you?
Well, it's very true. It's like, you know, people who live near the Oval cricket ground. Yeah. I know a couple of people with flats overlooking the ground.
Absolutely.
They've got loads of friends when there are matches on, you know, because everybody wants to come around and watch the game from their balconies.
Yeah.
Same as Wimbledon. Yeah. You know, if you've got a nice high-rise flat in Wimbledon, you can watch the tennis.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there is a specific place in Hyde Park. So you know where the Dorchester and the Hilton are?
Of course.
So that bit of Hyde Park opposite where those hotels are is where they always mount the stage.
Right. Right, I got it. Yeah, okay.
So you can't really park on that side, you see.
No,
you can't get close, and the enclosures are huge.
Yeah.
So the actual stage area and the spectators' enclosures are all then surrounded by hospitality areas, bars, restaurants, places to hang out. So you can't actually get that close if you're not inside with a ticket.
Yeah, no, I understand. Miss Jones, we don't talk politics in Planet Porky, although...
Yeah, we try not to.
Well, I'm honest to God. The sheer hypocrisy, the stupidity, the mishmash of you had a bit of cake, you had a beer, you had some curry, you were... I mean, honestly, it has left me so banjaxed. I've been in a few TV shows over the last couple of days, Miss Jones. As you know, I've now been...
You've become a major TV star over the last 2 years. I swear that it's the influence of our podcast that's done
well,
it for you.
For some bizarre reason, people think I'm a political expert now. Can you believe that?
Well, you do pontificate and you do have an opinion on all
Well, you do.
That's what you're there for. That's why they invite you.
Well, you do. But, I mean, to be honest... Do you know what, most of the time what happens these days is that you get onto shows and they, and I think it's a very good structure, you have a right winger and a left winger, you know. Now, I'm perceived as a right winger. I'm not really a right winger, to be honest. I like to sort of just do it down the middle. I think Piers Morgan is a do it down the middle guy, you know what I mean? You know, he can attack Donald Trump, but at the same time he can attack... Boris Johnson and he can support people. Anyway, that's by the way. All I'm saying is it makes for a very interesting life. And, you know, the amazing thing is you have to sort of try and be on top of everything now, because any minute now you could get a call saying, "Hi, Mike, what do you think about the latest government-issued action that... we're going to have to, in future, put the calorie count on food in shops," which I couldn't give a monkey's about, you know what I mean? But you've got to sort of be able to get up there and read about it. Anyway, look, Leslie Ann, I don't even want you to respond to that. What I want to talk to you about...
Why did you say it then?
Well, what I'm trying to do is... Most of this podcast has been showbiz, which I love. I love talking showbiz with you because you know everything about it. You're a world expert. So I thought... I think I'll just get, real on politics for 2 minutes and then go back to showbiz. And the showbiz I want to go back to is Ron Galella. Now, you probably know Ron Galella and his history a lot, you know, lot more than me. But I read his obituary in the Daily Telegraph yesterday, the most astonishing and probably the first ever paparazzo photographer.
Yes. I think we feel very differently about paparazzi today.
Right.
And I think the moment that our opinion turned was the night Princess Diana died in a road tunnel in Paris in 1997.
Okay.
Because there's a prevailing fury that her car was pursued by paparazzi.
I don't believe it for a moment, by the way.
On motorbikes and in cars and everything else.
I don't believe it for a moment. The driver of that car was drunk, and Diana and Dodi Fayed were put in the car by Fayed's father, Mohammed Al Fayed, out of the back door of the hotel in Paris that he owned and told to escape from the paparazzi.
Yeah, we know all that. But the fact is they were escaping from the paparazzi. You've just said it. So the paparazzi were there and they were escaping from them. So I feel that the global sense of what paparazzi are all about changed that night, because they were deemed to be responsible for that quick getaway and ultimately of her death, and of course Dodie's as well. But anyway,
Miss Jones, I have to put you on the spot. Do you think that the paparazzi drove Diana to her death?
Well, obviously they didn't drive her to her death, but they did pursue the car. And the car drove off at top speed because the paparazzi were there.
And the driver should have been used to that, because that happened all the time with Diana, and he should have been moderated, he should have been professional, he should never have tried to outrun a couple of guys on motorbikes following him.
Yeah, I agree. All I'm saying is, I'm not blaming anybody in this scenario. All I'm saying is, I feel that public opinion towards paparazzi photographers changed after that night.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I totally agree with that. But let's get back to Mr. Galella. You spent a lot of time in California. You once lived with Raquel Welch, didn't you, in California?
Oh, yes, I did.
So that's good. So you must have known about Galella. And what a fantastic story this guy is. He made his career based on literally stalking Jacqueline Onassis, okay, Jackie O. But he went after other great stars. And one time, Marlon Brando smashed him in the face and knocked five of his teeth out. That's not a very good thing to do to a journalist, is it?
That's violent. You know, yeah. I'm sure Marlon Brando wasn't done for that, but he should have been.
Yeah, of course he should. Yeah.
Because mostly paparazzo photographers do not provoke people. You always get a few who sort of taunt celebrities and try and get them to overreact and do stupid things.
Yeah.
But most of them are very respectful people. I'm talking about people like that we know, Dave Bennett, for example, Richard Young, you know, Dave Hogan. All these people have hung around politely outside of places, sometimes invited in, and they are there to capture photographs. And of course, these celebrities have PRs.
Yeah.
They want them to be in the papers the next day.
Yeah.
So there is a collusion going on.
Yeah.
And most paparazzi do not get in the way and do not do stupid things.
No.
But you're always going to get a few who do.
Yeah.
Do you remember years ago, there was a front page of the Sun newspaper, fantastic picture. It was Dave Hogan lying in the road, screaming in pain, writhing in agony.
Yeah.
And the headline was brilliant, a classic Calvin McKenzie. It was "Maimed by Madonna." And Madonna's limousine had run him over in the road. And I think Dave Bennett got the picture.
Yeah. And I'm sure Dave Hogan was told not to get up too quickly.
I'm sure that's the case. Yeah.
I've got a personal story here. When I worked in New York, I was there for like 3 years. Mick Jagger had a townhouse there. It wasn't a brownstone. It's much bigger, you know. And we'd occasionally go out and, you know, stalk him out and all that kind of stuff. And I think at the time, he was having a child with Jerry, what's her name? Jerry Hall.
Jerry Hall. Who wasn't he having a child?
Well, yes, that's absolutely right. But I remember so well. You know what I'm talking about, these townhouses in New York, they've always got like a basement flat. And there's always stairs that go down to the basement. You know, they, what do they call them? Like below level or something like that. You know what I mean? So.
There is a term for it.
Absolutely. Sub level or something like that. So anyway, the paparazzi photographer we employed, who wasn't anything like as famous as Mr. Galella, Ron Galella, he rings me, he says, "Hey, mate. It's Dave here." Oh, I don't think his name was Dave. I think his name was Don or something, you know. It's Don. He says, I got information. Jagger, he's going to be here at 7 o'clock, Mike. And I'm going to be there. I said, okay, fine. So that's good. So I got up there, you know. Anyway, his information was good. And, you know, this big limo turns up. Jagger gets out. And a load of people there. And Jagger brushes his way through it all, but he knocked my photographer down those stairs into the subflat, you know what I mean? And his cameras went crashing and all that kind of stuff, you know. And you won't believe it, that photographer, he got $250,000 in damages after he sued Jagger for assaulting him.
Well, of course, in America, you could do that.
Exactly. I mean,
if he tried to do that in London, everybody would have laughed you out of court.
Yes, no, but he did. And I was
You got as good as you gave.
Say again?
You got as good as you gave.
That's right. And I was called as a witness into the... I remember the court. It was downtown Manhattan. It was near the... it's near the mayor's place downtown, and I had to stand in. Oh, I remember this so funnily. So I had to go down and watch the first day of the hearing, okay, because I was being called as a witness on the second day. And on the first day, Mick Jagger comes into the box, you know, and the judge, who clearly was looking for an opportunity here, said, "Okay, Mr. Jagger. You're going to have to give information. You must tell the truth. Nothing but the truth. Are you understanding of that?" And Mick Jagger said, "Yes, Your Worship," or whatever, you know. And then the judge, to get a line, said, "Mr. Jagger, in order for the court to hear exactly what you're saying, you're going to have to speak into a microphone."
What was he, Irish?
He said, "You're going to have to speak into that microphone. Are you okay with microphones, Mr. Jagger?" And then the judge even laughed at his own joke. You know what I mean?
Oh, my goodness.
It was pretty obvious the way that was going. Miss Jones, I want to talk to you about what you think. This is all showbiz, by the way, but I suppose that's what it's all about. What do you think about that lady, Miss Kardashian, wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress? I mean,
Well, did you see the photos of her behind, as it were? I mean, everything is about the behind with Kim Kardashian, isn't it?
Yeah.
They showed, you know, because that beautiful gold dress that Marilyn Monroe wore to sing Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy, which fitted her like a glove.
Yeah.
But they showed some rear shots of Kim Kardashian wearing it.
It couldn't have fitted her, could it?
No, you could see her pants, and it was all laced together at the back, and great sort of swathes of open bits. I thought it looked terrible. I really think there's something quite seedy about that.
To me, it was sacrilegious. I mean that. It was sacrilegious. That was Marilyn Monroe's dress. Anybody else put it on? Listen, let's move on. I want to talk about Bono. Now, I've had a few issues with Bono over the years. What do I mean of issues? Always thought he was a bit sort of prissy and a bit sort of, you know, up his own sort of...
He's a bit of a prick.
And prick and all that. But then I suddenly see over the last couple of days that he's gone over to Ukraine with The Edge. His name's Dave something, isn't it? The Edge. He's a, you know, great guitarist in
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't.
He's been The Edge for such a long time.
But it doesn't matter. And they go into a subway station in Kyiv, which used to be called Kiev, and they play just with, you know, guitars that are not wired up, what are they called, acoustic guitars, and they play a couple of U2. And I have to say, I think that was, I mean, Bono is one of the richest rock stars in the world, literally. He's invested well into a load of social media sites and all that kind of stuff. I think that was brilliant.
Well, I don't. Actually, I think it's all very well, these famous superstar rock stars going off and playing in a subway where in a country where there's a war on. Why don't they just put their hand in their pocket and dish out a few million and try and get all those poor people out of Mariupol?
They could do that anytime. And they could shell out the millions
anytime.
Why
don't they do that instead?
They could do that anytime. What about going there, having a presence? Kyiv is still not a safe city, okay? Boris Johnson went there. Other people have gone there, but it could still be bombed at any time by the madman Putin. I think for them to actually go there and place themselves in danger, I think it was great.
May I ask, what good did it do? Did anybody pause in their efforts to save their own lives and to save other people and to try and get a bit of a crust down a starving old woman's neck? Did anybody stop and think, how marvellous that Bono and The Edge are here to entertain us in our torment?
But I think what it might have done is, I think because that picture went all around the world, it would have once again opened up, you know, the world's concern about what's going on in Ukraine.
I get that, but I think we know.
Yeah, but I think they managed to go there and, you know, once again, multiply the concern around the world. Bono's there. He had a few words afterward and said, "This is dreadful." I think it was great. Listen,
understatement of the year. I tell you what I'm surprised about, that St. Bob hasn't popped his head over the parapet and isn't trying to organise a concert.
Well,
maybe in neighbouring Slovakia or something.
You know, it's funny you should say that. But Sir Bob or Lord Bob, whatever his name is now, St. Bob.
Is he Lord Bob or is he God Bob?
God Bob or something.
Not quite sure.
He can't go anywhere unless he's got a black and white scarf wrapped around his face so he looks like he's Lawrence of Arabia. You see what I mean? Because that's what he normally
does. Or Yasser Arafat.
Yasser Arafat, yeah, I love that, yeah. Absolutely right. Listen, not much time left on this podcast, Miss Jones. We have to have a Beatles story. Strawberry Fields Forever was a compilation of two versions of a song that John Lennon wrote. I just want to say to our millions of listeners, we've got to give you a Beatles story, and I think this is a great one.
It is a great story, yes. It's sort of not the first time this kind of thing happens, because bands quite often lay down different versions of a new song, a track that they want to experiment with. On this occasion, because John was off making a film, How I Won the War, so they laid down the first version of it, and off he goes to do a bit of filming. And George Martin thought it was absolutely beautiful when he first heard this song. This is their producer. And then back comes John, and he decides to make a different version of the song, which was a bit heavier, a bit more rocky. And George Martin thought, well, okay, yeah, this is quite good as well, but why not? We'll record this version as well. So there's Jeff Emerick, the engineer, sitting there in the control rooms, a bit behaving himself, thinking, they were always stunned by what was going on. John at this stage asked George Martin to come up with some new pieces, a new score for cellos and trumpets and this kind of thing, and they recorded it again. As I said, it's a much heavier version. John goes away again. Then he comes back and he says, I've been thinking about this. There are elements of the first version that I really love, and also I like bits of the second version. So what I'd like you to do is splice them together. At which point George Martin says, not sure I can do that, John, because they're in different keys.
Sorry, who asked to splice together? The engineer or?
No, John Lennon asked George Martin, the producer. Right. He's, George Martin, the miracle worker, who could walk on water and do anything. And John just assumed that George would be able to do this. He says, well, they are at different tempos. This is where the magic kicks in, because John Lennon liked the beginning of the first one and the end of the second version. And John said, you can fix it, George. So Jeff and George get together. Get this, right? They slowed down take 26 by 11.5%. This is the exact amount they slowed it down by. And when they slowed down take 26, the tempos and the keys of the two versions matched perfectly.
So
How magic is that?
Is that where we now get, let me take you down, because I'm going to...
Ba-doom, ba-doom. If you listen really closely, you can actually hear the joins.
My God.
You can, especially when cellos kick in. So if you sit and listen to that really, really carefully, you can hear it. It's unbelievable. The story is unbelievable, but it's another example of the George Martin magic, you got to know the Beatles story to know, that George was the fifth Beatle and how important he was in the creation and the recording of their music.
And in the end, John Lennon, when asked, how important was George Martin, John Lennon very cruelly said, how many number ones has George Martin written? Which was a bit harsh, wasn't it?
He didn't mean it, and they did make it up. They did have dinner in New York, and John was an angry young man at that point.
And when you're a genius, you're allowed to say a lot of things about the things you do. The reason I brought this up, Miss Jones, is because I read that the reason that John Lennon wrote Strawberry Fields in the first place was, you've already alluded to the fact that he was out in Spain or somewhere making a film, and he looked out of the balcony of the room you're staying in, and he looked down on the gardens below him, and he thought, that looks like Strawberry Fields, where I grew up. Is that right?
Strawberry Fields was a children's home that was where he lived with Auntie Mimi in Walton, Liverpool. If he climbed the apple tree at the back of Auntie Mimi's garden, he could look down into the grounds of this children's home. And Then he took to climbing a bit higher up the tree and jumping down into the gardens to play with the kids. And he remembered that as a paradise when his life became very complicated. Yeah. His mother died. Yeah. His father had legged it. John was a very dysfunctional person.
Yeah.
And the thing that encapsulated the innocence of his childhood at a certain point and a memory to which he returned throughout his life, he thought of Strawberry Fields. Mm. And we know the Strawberry Fields Memorial in Central Park in New York.
Absolutely.
With the black and white sort of mosaic memorial to him.
Where some say his ashes are buried below.
Yeah, it's rumoured, but I don't believe it because it would be too easy to desecrate, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. Right. Okay. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. A sparkling podcast, even though I say it myself, and most of it because of your input, Miss Jones. You know, absolutely scintillating and brilliant information about all those things that we all love from growing up throughout our lives. Okay, folks, thank you very much for having joined us for this edition of Life on Planet Porky, and we'll be back with you again very soon. As I'm walking past the stairs from the underground car park, there's two people coming up and they're making an awful lot of noise. I'm not joking. It was, you know, what do you know about it? Don't speak to me like that. How dare you? Fuck you. All this kind of stuff. You know, honestly, these two people coming up from these stairs into Sloane Square.
Lingo, Mr. Parry.
Sorry?
Lingo. It's a family show.
Well, I know it is, but I excuse myself by saying that is direct quotation of what I heard, okay?
Verbatim.
Verbatim, thank you. Yeah, that's a great journalist expression. Verbatim.
Years ago, that was a front page of the Sun newspaper. Fantastic picture. It was Dave Hogan lying in the road, screaming in pain, writhing in agony. Yeah. And the headline was brilliant, a classic Kelvin McKenzie. It was maimed by Madonna. And Madonna's limousine had run him over in the road. And I think Dave Bennett got the picture. Yeah.
And I'm sure Dave Hogan was told not to get up too quickly.
I'm sure that's the case. Oh. Yeah.
Mr. Jagger, in order for the court to hear exactly what you're saying, you're going to have to speak into a microphone.
What was he, Irish?
Yeah.